This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
This is the afternoon session of the education track on Monday.
May you be made strong with all the strength that comes from His glorious power, and may you be prepared to endure everything with patience while joyfully giving thanks to the Father who has enabled you to share in the inheritance of the saints and the light. He has rescued us from the power of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of His Son, in whom we have redemption and forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in Him all things in heaven and earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through Him and for Him. Let's bow in prayer as we get started this afternoon. Our Father, we thank You for the opportunity to gather here for InterVarsity's national and international ministry and its efforts to encourage graduate students to become leaders in their fields, whether it be academic or professional, to encourage the professionals and professors themselves. Pray that this conference may be a real time of encouragement. We thank You, Lord, that You have rescued us from the power of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of Your Son. Not that we have anything that makes us deserving of that honor, but as we think through the implications of faith issues for the public schools and for the private schools, for colleges and universities this afternoon, pray that we can be engaged, thinking through issues that might have bothered us and maybe thinking through issues that are new to us. Let Your Holy Spirit be here among us, in Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Well, welcome back. I do not have an English accent. I've always kind of been jealous of people like John Stott, who used to speak at most of the older InterVarsity meetings, and N.T. Wright with a nice English accent. I have a New Jersey accent, which is the best of all possible worlds, so I can't really complain very much. Okay, as I had mentioned, I'm Ernie Belathy. I do not have a name tag, so it looks like I'm not going to eat tonight. I've got to locate that thing. And I'm from State University of New York at Geneseo. I've been teaching there for about 25 years. I'm a former chairperson of the education department there. And right now I'm the program director for reading and literacy. My major areas of scholarly interest are in computer-based instruction. I've written two books on that. Metacognition, I've done a fair amount of research on metacognition and summarizing. And then also, and more recently, literacy efforts for struggling readers. And my most recent book was called Struggling Readers, Teaching and Assessing Reading, K-8. So I want to welcome you here today, and we have two really special speakers. But I thought I'd start off with some introductory material. As I've been thinking through what the purpose of this track is, I felt that we had two major purposes. One thing that we aren't really aiming to do is to inspire you to serve children and young people as teachers. My assumption is you're pretty much there already. Now, who knows, maybe we will be a little bit inspirational on that score. We hope to give you some good advice, some guidelines for surviving and thriving as a Christian in public and private schools and colleges and universities. But I want to remind you that you already have rich resources at home in your churches. Every church that I've ever gone to has had a lot of teachers in it. And going home, making contact with those teachers, talking to them, networking with them, pushing them to be God's people in the school, maybe sharing with them some of the things you've been learning at this conference, and letting them push you. That's going to be your richest resource. So what are we aiming to do? Basically, I think what we're trying to do here is to get you thinking about the next steps in your life, about where you're going to be 5 years from now, or 10 years, or 20 years, as God leads. Could be in an ivory tower, in academia, and we have two representatives as on the staff here. Nat, I've been around for a long time. I'm a full professor. And we have a professor at just more or less starting your career in academia here. Could be becoming the person God wants you to be in the academic and scholarly aspects of education. There are a lot of job openings for professors of education, and not necessarily in the philosophy of education. Those, unfortunately, are a dime a dozen. But the number of people going into special education, into academia, in special education, in reading education, there's a huge need for those areas, science education, math education. It could also be maybe you're going to be an educational leader or entrepreneur, living out your God-given personal vision in a way that's enlarged beyond your present thinking. If you're at the beginning stages of your career, probably entrepreneurial vision is not something you've been thinking too much about. At least I wasn't at the beginning stages of my career. But we have an excellent representative. We'll be talking about leadership and entrepreneurship in education. Jenna will be speaking about that. Or it might be that you're going to decide to spend your life in the classroom, becoming a senior teacher or a mentor or a coach. We need a lot of those in the classroom. What makes a difference in education is the teacher. The more teachers we can have who are dedicated to teaching, who are dedicated to excellence, and also dedicated to the Lord, will be a tremendous benefit for the schools. I want to remind you of the two basic principles that I was talking about last night. Maybe I'll add some as we go along. Remember, there are three rules in teaching. Be flexible, be flexible, and be flexible. Those are the three major rules of teaching. I'm sure you've heard of them before. So my first ground rule is be flexible. As I mentioned last night, Donald Miller in Blue Like Jazz says, if you're not changing, you're not following Jesus. And Tom and Shanna and I may be saying things that you disagree with. We may be saying things that are controversial. Hopefully we'll be raising a few people's hackles. It's nice to get the blood pressure going and increase engagement levels. But keep in mind that we haven't arrived. We're still learning and changing. So be flexible. You may not agree with us when we're saying something controversial, but give us a chance and come back at us. That's part of what we're here for. Remember that 2 or 5 or 10 years from now, you may have grown some and changed your mind, and hopefully we will have too. So, first ground rule, be flexible. Second ground rule, also that I mentioned last night, has to do with distributed expertise. We're depending on you to agree, disagree, add your own comments. Without that, I think we're going to have a much more impoverished time. So make sure you feel free to join in. And especially the second half of this afternoon, we're going to be having lots of opportunities for that. One of my colleagues at SUNY Geneseo has a favorite saying, for every complex problem, there is a solution that is clear, obvious, logical, and above all, simple. And that solution is inevitably wrong. We're all hoping at this point that the simple solution of giving $700 billion to the richest people in the United States is going to solve a lot of economic problems. We'll see. Simple solution, but I'm not sure. Education in the United States presents not just one complex problem for evangelical Christians, but a host of complex problems. Part of the complexity stems from the differing social and political situations in which we find ourselves. There may be public schools here in the United States where a Christian organization can comfortably present an evangelistic assembly, school-wide evangelistic assembly. And there may be schools in which the Lord's Prayer could be chanted at the beginning of every school day. And maybe there are schools in which John McCain was actually suspect as a presidential candidate because he wasn't Christian enough. Well, I'm afraid, at least as far as I am concerned, you're going to have to find others to help you think through the implications of those political and social settings. The schools that I operate in are multicultural, they are liberal, they're pluralistic, they're diverse. They have children of African-American backgrounds, Puerto Rican, Mexican, European, Turkish and Ukrainian, Chinese, Somalian, Cambodian, My schools have children in whose homes a variety of languages are spoken. They have some Christian evangelical students who think that our next president, Barack Obama, is a thoughtful, considerate, unifying man of faith. And other Christian evangelical students, such as those in the Bible after-school Bible study group that my daughter leads, who call him the Antichrist. In fact, my schools have Christian students of all different stripes, of all different levels of allegiance to Jesus, as well as Sikhs and Buddhists and Hindus, theists, apatheists. If you've been reading the research work of Christian Smith at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, schools and churches are filled with moralistic, therapeutic deists, which is apparently the new in thing this generation, atheists, secularists, and many others. So it's bewildering. And if you come away from this track with a clear idea as to the direction that American schooling should go in, then I think you're going to be doing a lot better or worse than I've been able to do. In my almost 10 years as a public school teacher and more than 25 years as a teacher of teachers. So let's get started. Our first presenter, and I'd actually like our presenters to rehearse who they are a little bit and what they've been doing so that you can get a better idea as to what their interests are and what's going on in their lives from them and from me. So Tom, if you would start us off by reminding us who you are. Tom Baskin is a professor at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, and he's going to be speaking on the topic of forgiveness is a choice.
Great. Thank you. Let me go ahead and start the PowerPoint. I've got a couple different titles. I've got Forgiveness in Psychology and Education and Forgiveness is a Choice. You'll see how those are really the same title. This will relate to my background in terms of, I am Tom Baskin. I'm a professor at UW-Milwaukee. I'm in the Educational Psychology Department within the counseling area. My primary responsibility is to train school counselors and to train doctoral level therapists. And to try to get more doctoral level therapists interested in the school, which I've had some success with now. I've got 3 doctoral students who are interested in that. And that's helpful. I'm an assistant professor, so I'm on the publisher-perish track. So I've been publishing some, and hopefully I will not perish. But I constantly have that pressure. So for me, there's also a constant pressure between time with students, which is valuable in itself, but it doesn't get me to publications versus publications, which can be a lot of work, and there's a lot of different steps in terms of collecting data, and it's always hard to find time to write. But I make that a priority and have been progressing in that. So that's kind of what I, my struggles. Go ahead.
What's your teaching look?
I teach 2 classes per semester, which is nice, although with the budget, they're recently having budget cuts and a lot of pressure, and we're probably going to be teaching more than that. Milwaukee, it's also, just briefly, they're having a bit of an identity crisis, or I don't know if I could say that strongly, but I would say Milwaukee is in the case where they want to be more of a research institution. So they're working, they're constantly trying to get resources, trying to become more of a research institution, which I think puts pressure on the teaching aspect. My background is I got my doctorate at UW-Madison, and part of the reason Forgiveness is a Choice comes from the name of this book, Forgiveness is a Choice. And this book is by Robert D. Enright. He is a mentor of mine, and he is a professor at UW-Madison. So a lot of what I'm sharing is going to be his efforts. If you are interested in what I'm talking about, one of the best things you can do is get this book. I think it's $14 on Amazon.com. Again, Forgiveness is a Choice, Robert Enright.
Is it here?
It's not here. I'm quite disappointed. I did look. I requested it. And there seems to be, I love Ivy Press, but it seems like most of the books are Ivy Press.
I think I saw it, actually.
You saw this?
On a little table over in a corner. There,
oh, yeah.
There was a
copy. I did request it.
It's here.
You think it's here?
Yeah.
Well, okay, then I stand corrected.
Right.
Good. So it's down there. Unfortunately, you check the price. I guess everything's discounted. So.
Everything's, it's less than it is normally, at least.
Okay, that's great.
Everything
so,
that's non-university is great.
Well, that's good. That's the same discount Amazon gives, so that's very good. So it is down there. I'm sorry, Enright. Good. So this book chronicles forgiveness. This is made to be a we use this as a very helpful guide. It's mostly directed towards one person forgiving, but it's very helpful in terms of helping others to forgive. And what my talk is going to be around, so when I say forgiveness in psychology and education, what my talk is going to focus around is how Enright has been successful in bringing forgiveness into psychology. He's a leader in the field. There's now a number of people studying forgiveness, but in my unbiased opinion, he is the number one researcher in that. And I'll show you some of the ways that he's really brought it. When he first studied it about 20 to 25 years ago, he got a lot of negative feedback from the university. This doesn't belong. This shouldn't be here. And he thought, huh. For those of you who know Kohlberg, he did Kohlbergian moral development. And the day he got tenure, he said that he was well known in his field. He got tenure at Madison, which is a strong university. And he said there was 12 other people in the world that knew what he did. And that wasn't good enough for him. So the reason he got into forgiveness was because he wanted to make an impact on more people. What's also interesting about that, I'll go ahead and go to the first slide. So he introduced a forgiveness model. So there's a number of forgiveness models. His one has 20 steps in it, which is what he goes through in this book. I'm also going to talk about the steps. Oh, actually, I also have a handout, which go ahead and everybody take one. It talks about his, he gives his model on one side and some of the research I'm going to talk about on the other side. Go ahead and everybody can take one. So what he, when he was starting off doing it, he wanted to make more of an impact. And one thing that's also interesting from a faith perspective is that he actually was not a committed Christian when he made this choice and when he decided to study forgiveness. And part of his interest in forgiveness did is it actually forced him to be a stronger Christian. And he now is a strong and committed Christian. And partially he was like, what's this about? You know, why are people so against this topic? And in a lot of ways, for him, and I think one thing he sees it as is a way of, it makes people have to make a decision and kind of decide how committed they are to something. And so that was true for him. The name forgiveness as a choice comes out from the idea of making it clear that it's a choice. And in some ways, he, I would say, everything that he does is, he is a committed Christian, everything he does is consistent with Christianity, although he doesn't look at it exactly the way most churches look at it. He has a few different spins on forgiveness that become important, and part of the issue of a choice is he wants to always emphasize that the person, it's got to be a choice for that person. If someone feels like they have to do it, then that takes away some of the power of it and some of the grace involved. And he would basically believe that it's basically always wise to forgive, but that he still wants to emphasize that it's a choice. So what he did then is, he made a model of forgiveness. So one way of kind of introducing it into science was he made a model of forgiveness that involves 20 steps, which is the handout that you have there. And then if you notice, the steps are put into kind of four phases. I'll go over that more in depth later, but just 20 steps, four phases. And what that does is it shows kind of the scientific progression. It shows the progression psychologically, and that kind of helps, quote unquote, legitimize it. The other thing that he did that really helped to legitimize his study of forgiveness is he did a lot of interventions. So this is about forgiveness. It's also called forgiveness therapy. And basically what forgiveness therapy is bringing in people who are angry and giving them a trained therapist to walk through it. So what he did was
does the therapist have to be a believer more than you don't have to be a Christian believer?
So he intentionally makes it so you do not have to be a believer. And in the book, he doesn't. It's never required to be a believer. Although I'd probably say 90% of the people who are interested in this and who have practiced it are believers, but you don't have to be a believer. And part of that is, what's interesting about that is one of his early, he had two of his early students. One of them was Monsignor, which I think is a priest, was a Catholic priest, and the other student was the head of the Muslim student organization. So he's definitely tries to be broad, but it's interesting that it's attracted Catholic priests. It's also attracted the head of the Muslim student organization. So I think it's been a healthy kind of wide tent in terms of kind of helping people to have a dialogue and people of different faiths. Yet again, I think there's something very core to the Christian faith that this affirms and works well with. Another thing to give you an overview, I'm going to start off talking about the psychology of it, and that's what's helped legitimize the science of it. Over time, he started to move more into education, and I started to move more into education. We're both located in colleges of education. Towards the end of the presentation, I'll show you how it's been established in psychology, and it's moving more towards applications in education. To legitimize it, to do the forgiveness therapy, he did interventions. So parentally love-deprived college students, incest survivors, post-abortion male partners, so it was male partners who disagreed with an abortion decision of their partner. What he did is a number of interventions where people were a therapist. So I would say the most powerful intervention was with incest survivors. In that one, a therapist, a trained doctoral therapist, recruited 12 incest survivors, all women, and they did a randomized controlled study where she worked with six of them while six of them were on a wait list. And what she did is she went through the steps and she gave everybody in that therapy, all six of those incest survivors that she was working with, she said, we're going to go through these steps, you can take as long as you want on every step. And what's also interesting about it is a lot of the incest survivors had spent years in classical therapy and had not gotten better. So she brought them in. It was Susie Friedman was the person who did this, a doctoral student at UW-Madison, and she's also a Christian. She brought them through and, again, gave them as much time as they wanted. They took an average of 64 weeks. So 64 weeks of therapy. So it's 64 sessions once a week. So you can realize that's a lot of therapy, and they got significantly better through forgiveness therapy. And so what that is able to do, and I'll show you more, I have a graph that's going to show that a little more, but the idea is that what we're able to do is put it within the context of psychology, put it within the context and the means in which psychologists show their science. And when he was able to do it in the way that psychologists do it and be successful at it, then that was able to open the doors. Okay. So that's what I was saying here. So most forgiveness interventions have done strong results. In 2004, I'm giving a paper there that I did with Dr. Enright. By then, 9 interventions had done forgiveness therapy. So there's 9 interventions of forgiveness therapy, and then I'll give you. I'll try not to give you too much of the science. I don't know how people's statistics are, but I'll just give you a brief snapshot to just show kind of how it's been legitimized. What we did with these 9 studies is there was a debate within the psychological world of, is it just about a decision? So there's 3 types of interventions. There was decision interventions, there was group interventions, and there was individual interventions. So one way that Enright moved the science forward is he insisted it's a process. I think it's a long process. Now, I think that's entirely consistent with the Bible, that it's a long process, although oftentimes in churches, I think people see it more as a decision. And a lot of times it's like, okay, well, do you forgive the person? Okay, so now, you know, pray and forgive, and now it's over, and it's done. And what happened was, is people did interventions like that, and what the science showed is it doesn't really work. So what this graph is trying to show is these are levels of forgiveness. What you do in psychology, we're big on what's called effect sizes. I'm just going to say very briefly what an effect size is. You take a standard, you take a measure, and you take how much it's changed, and you divide it by a standard deviation of that measure. So an effect size of 1.0 means that people improved by one standard deviation, which is a lot of improvement. Okay, so to simplify it, but to give you the real simple answer, this, think of it as a scale where this is the starting point, and the further you go this way, the better. And this blue line is 0.5, that would be considered good, and then 0.8 is considered what you would expect in long-term individual therapy. So figure 10 sessions of $100 an hour therapy, you would expect to improve to this point here. Okay, so what did we show in this meta-analysis? Well, this meta-analysis of these 9 different studies, what we showed is with just the decision, people didn't get better with forgiveness. When we took them through a group process, they got this much better, which is significant. When we took them through an individual process, so group process means like a group intervention. Individual is where you're working just with the therapist. What you can see is the group was effective and the individual was amazingly effective. But what's also significant about this is the top results are for forgiveness. Well, initially psychologists say, okay, well that's nice, but I've never had anybody who really, you know, my clients don't come in and say they care about forgiveness. What they come in is they say they care about their mental health or their emotional health, which is down here. And so what Enright was able to do is say, okay, I'll do it on your terms. We'll look at, on your terms, we'll use your measures, we'll use depression, we'll use anxiety, we'll use those kinds of measures, and let's see how this forgiveness therapy does on those measures. And so that's the bottom line here. And so what happened, and what becomes powerful is if you look here with the decision, so again, the decision did not help people's emotions, so it's not just a decision. But with this long process model, in a group, there was a change of about 0.6, which again, 5 is good, 8 is powerful. So the group interventions did well. But then getting back to the individual interventions, and that was 2. That was 1 with the abortion men who disagreed with the abortion decision of their partner, and the incest study that I told you about is this line here. Okay, and that's very powerful because if you look, their results, 1.4. So this is good. This is $100 an hour psychotherapy is this line here. We're over here. So what he's able to do is to show that using the tools of psychology, the depression and anxiety, and taking clients, incest survivors, who had years of therapy and not been successful, all of a sudden with this forgiveness therapy, they were able to have these exciting results and say, hey, see, on your terms, we were able to have these results. Go ahead.
Can you say how you briefly measure forgiveness or emotional health? I mean, you boiled it down to one single number, right?
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, just very, because I have no clue about
it. Sure, that's fine. So all of these measures are what's called self-report measures. So when you, and the classic way is something called the Beck Depression Inventory. If you want to know if someone is depressed, there's something called I don't know how much people have this background at all, but Aaron Beck is the biggest person in depression, famous psychiatrist, and he's got the Beck Depression Inventory. So what you do is you place in front of a person 21 questions, and it's all about Likert scales. You probably know Likert scales, where it's like 0 to 4. So it'll be, how have you slept in the past? It's all about the last 2 weeks. In the last 2 weeks, how have you slept? Have you felt sad? Have you eaten less? Have you eaten a lot more? There's 21 questions that people use, and that's the standard within depression. If you want to see if someone's depressed, you give them a Beck Depression Inventory. They answer 21 questions, they bubble it in, and you bring it, and in about 5 minutes you score it, and you know what their Beck Depression Inventory is. But why that's so powerful is because this has literally been given to millions of people. And so for example, myself as a trained therapist, if I give a Beck Depression Inventory, I've now given so many of them and I'm so familiar with it, that once I give it to someone and I get that, boil it down to a number, it's meaningful. Because I've found over time that when people score high on that, it means it works, they're depressed, or if they score low, they're not depressed. So that's true with all of these different things. So with anxiety, there's another test. With forgiveness, Enright invented a test that talks about forgiveness. And so all of these involve self-report measures that you boil down to a score. Does that make sense? And then what the standard design is what's called a waitlist control. So with the incest survivors, and it's what we've done in a number of different situations, you bring in 12 incest survivors, you randomize them, which is very important. Six of them get the so everybody gets the tests. Then six of them get the intervention, six of them don't get the intervention. That goes on for a year. The researcher did a very good job of staying in contact with the people that weren't getting the intervention so they didn't drop out. If they start dropping out, you get problems with your research model. You give the intervention over a year. At the end of that year, you give everybody the measures again. Okay? And then that shows, then you can compare the people that got it to the people that didn't get it. And the second step in that, which is both humane and scientific, is now the people that didn't get the intervention get the intervention, which has two things. First of all, you know, from a social justice point of view, they get the intervention. The second thing is, now you can see what happens. And what happened was, is they didn't change over that year where they didn't get an intervention, they didn't get better. But then after that year where they got the intervention, they did get better. And then what you also do at the end of that is, the people that got the intervention, you give it to them after a year, and you hope that they haven't regressed back. And in this case, they did not regress back. They stayed very well. So that's another thing that shows the effectiveness of the intervention.
You do like really long term, like 5 or 10 years?
No, that would... So actually, this intervention was about a year, and that's a year is considered very long term. It's probably pretty standard to do about 10 weeks. And even a 3-month follow-up would be considered very good. So a 1-year follow-up is amazing, and yeah, I mean, yeah. But that's a good question. Did you have a question?
So you kind of did a pre and post measure.
So just pre and post. Yeah, just pre and post. Pre and post, and then the follow-up.
Okay. No, I know you said that you wanted to know how you measure forgiveness. Did you use the Beck to measure forgiveness?
No, so the Beck is only for depression.
Right.
So for forgiveness, Enright made, there's something called the Enright Forgiveness Inventory.
Okay, that's my one.
Yeah, so he made an inventory based around forgiveness. Okay, so that's a lot of the science of it, and we can keep talking about the science of it, but one thing to help with this is, and this was very important, was having a good definition of forgiveness. Okay? So his definition of forgiveness was the willful giving up of resentment in the face of another's or other's considerable injustice and responding with beneficence to the offender, even though that offender has no right to the forgiver's moral goodness. So this is the definition, and it's very important. So it's giving up. So a lot of things get ended as part of therapy that are very important. One thing is you have to establish is that what the person did was wrong. Okay? So, and this book is good about talking about that. But, you know, that's a lot of times what ends up happening with forgiveness is it ends up being too much like condoning, where you say, okay, well, it wasn't that big of a deal, or things like that. Well, obviously, an example with incest survivors, obviously it was a big deal and it was wrong. So the first step in Enright's forgiveness is, or an important point in his definition is, it was wrong. And from a Christian standpoint, we can agree with that. It was wrong. So what Enright does with this important definition is say, it was wrong, but I'm going to choose to let go of it. Now, another thing that's significant about what Enright did in forgiveness that's a little different than what most churches do is he separated reconciliation and forgiveness. So he basically says forgiveness is about your attitude towards the other person. Now you can see how that could be very important for incest survivors. Because oftentimes, the people who they're dealing with are unrepentant. And it's not safe. You know, a lot of times that's a dilemma, and I think that can be a dilemma within Christian churches. So this is tricky. You know, in the Bible it talks about, you know, if someone has offended you, be reconciled to them. And that has an important point, an important part. But what Enright chose was, and I think correctly chose, was that at its best, there's two steps. There's forgiveness and reconciliation. And that's still the best. The best is if there can be the forgiveness and reconciliation. But a lot of times, there is not that chance to reconcile. And again, with the incest survivor, if the person hasn't admitted what's wrong, if the person is still a dangerous person, there's plenty of situations where it's not safe to reconcile. And so what he did was he split those two things in two. it still is hope that that the reconciliation takes place. But what's obviously important about that is it's able to help people who have been hurt, but the person who hurt them is unrepentant, and it's able to kind of allow them to go through a process of their own where they forgive. This also becomes, we'll talk more about making it into education, but what I work with is I work with bringing it into the urban inner city. And most recently we've had a project where we're working with African American students who are in very dangerous circumstances. And oftentimes they've had, a fairly common thing is they've had a cousin or a relative who's been killed or injured in a fight. And that's a lot of times something that we forgive. What I'm making about this is, I think his definition has been very good in terms of, we still want those kids to know how to protect themselves. They feel very angry, they feel very hurt. If we were sending, there's a lot of situations where we can't send them to reconcile. That sending them to reconcile with somebody is not necessarily going to work. And so I think it can be controversial within the Christian community in terms of, well, how are you, you know, that you shouldn't separate those two. But I think it has been a worthwhile decision. And working with African American students, there's a way in which we have to say, yes, you're very angry. We want to talk through with you forgiveness, which helps them. But we also want to say, you know what, there's ways in which you live in a very dangerous part of the world, and we want to help you to be safe. And so there's not necessarily the same opportunity to reconcile as we would like, but we still see forgiveness as a helpful choice for them. And what we believe is that when those students have forgiven and they're less angry, they're able to make better choices. Now, we hope in the long term that they will be able to reconcile, but basically we believe and we have seen how when they reduce their anger, when they deal with their anger, their lives are better. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so then again, the 20-step model, I mentioned that already. 20-step model has the four phases, and that breaks down this long process into key phases. Okay, and I'm going to go ahead and quickly go over those, kind of some of what the steps it talks about. Okay, so the first thing is, and probably the most time intensive, is the first 8 steps, which is what's called the uncovering phase. And so what NRI is really good, again, it's not just about a decision, but it's about working through an extended process, okay? And in the uncovering phase, that's what you have people do. So they examine their psychological defenses, they confront their anger, the point is to release, not harbor the anger. They admit that there's shame when appropriate. Sometimes they feel shame about what happened to them. They're aware of cathexis. Cathexis is grabbing on to something. So if you feel hurt and you keep thinking about it, keep perseverating over it, keep running through it in your mind, that's cathexis. And a lot of what happens is, a lot of times pain is toxic. When you've been injured, it's hurtful to you because you can't get over it. You keep rehearsing it in your mind. And a lot of what the forgiveness therapy does is helps people to resolve it in a way that they don't have to keep reliving it. Okay, awareness of cognitive rehearsal of the offense. So cathexis is sticking with it. The cognitive rehearsal is what I was just talking about, where you keep thinking about it. Insight to the injured party, maybe comparing self with the injurer. So you may be feeling like, I got hurt, but the other person got away with something. Realization that oneself may be permanently and adversely changed by the injury. And insight into a possibly altered just worldview, meaning you may now believe that the world is a much more dangerous place than you thought it was before. So what this is a key series of steps in saying, bringing people through what's happened. And again, this is to Enright's credit, he's made it a long process, which I think is appropriate to the thing. I think in the past, and I know that I was encouraged, I mean, well-meaning people in church would be, okay, you were hurt, now forgive, and it was basically about a 10-minute process, or I think a lot of times it was thought of as a 10-minute process, but it didn't quite work for me. At least that was my personal experience. Other people may have different experiences. Now, having said that, Enright, this specifically is targeted towards a very deep injury. Now, sometimes there's a smaller injury, or there's certain injuries that you can forgive in 5 to 10 minutes, or it was something that bothered you, but you realize it wasn't that significant. And those things, Enright would encourage you to forgive quickly. But mostly that's not what he's at in this. What he's targeting is a deep injury. And there are other researchers that have tried to do, and part of what the decision thing is, other researchers have tried to do shorter interventions or have tried to focus on smaller injuries. And, for example, going into an undergraduate college class and saying, and kind of assuming that everybody has a big injury and talking through forgiveness. Well, what's happened there is they have not had as effective as a result. What Enright has found is that this is really effective for people who have a deep injury that they want to deal with. And so what we really see it as is a subset. It isn't necessarily everybody that needs this. It's people who are deeply injured. Okay, and then, so moving on, what I'd say about that, I would say the forgiveness therapy is targeted towards people deeply injured. Now, there's a philosophy there, consistent with Christianity, that having a forgiving mindset or forgiving worldview is helpful, and Enright would affirm that. But specifically, forgiveness therapy is going to be most powerful with the people who are in the most need, which obviously makes sense. Okay, so the first phase was that uncovering phase where you figure out what's going on. Okay, then once people understand what's going on, then he brings people through a decision phase, which actually isn't just a decision, but a decision phase, where you talk about having a change of heart, new insights, conversion, basically wanting to do something differently, wanting to have a change. He says willingness to consider forgiveness is an option, and then commit. And then kind of 11 is the commitment to forgive the offender. Okay, but even with the commitment to forgive the offender, Enright doesn't think of it as completed. Okay, so then he goes on to the work phase, and the work phase involves reframing through role taking who the wrongdoer is by viewing him or in context, empathy towards the offender, awareness of compassion as it emerges towards the offender, acceptance and absorption of the pain. So what this is basically, so like the reframing is saying, okay, you know, I thought of it as I was the victim and they were the perpetrator, which is true. The person going through this is the victim and the person the perpetrator. But what this also can allow, and the empathy part can allow, is to say, okay, you know, I'm guessing that part of the reason they lashed out was because they were injured. And so with incest, it's pretty common that the person who is the perpetrator had a pretty horrendous childhood, and it's pretty common that they were abused as a child. So it's important in this process that it's not still not condoning, it's still not okay that they did it, but there's an explanation of, okay, and an understanding of, oh, now I see that they were also hurt. And can be an understanding of saying, I can have empathy for them, that they're in a bad situation also. And then the key part here is this acceptance and absorption of the pain, which I think is definitely a Christian principle in terms of, there is this cycle of violence. There's a sense of this pain, and there's this temptation to try to get even or try to hurt someone else is the common theme. And so what encourages people to do is to absorb the pain and say, I'm not, you know, I was hurt by it, but that's where this is going to end. And I'm going to bear the burden. I'm not going to hurt others. And in fact, I'm going to forgive. And by forgiving, I'm giving a gift to the other person. They deserve bad thing. You know, they've earned something bad. They've earned something negative, but that's not what I'm going to give them. I'm going to give them forgiveness. I'm going to release them from that burden. Okay, and then the final series of things is, once you've done that, it's called the outcome phase, or in his book he actually calls it the discovery and release from emotional prison. And you work through finding meaning for self and others in the suffering. So finding meaning that I suffered through this, but somehow it gives me a new sense of life. Realization that the self has needed others' forgiveness in the past. Insight that one is not alone. Realization that the self may have a new purpose in life because of the injury. Awareness of a decreased negative affect and perhaps increased positive affect as begins to emerge towards the injurer. Awareness of the internal emotional release. So a new purpose, there may be ways, especially something like incest survivor, as this person's been able to forgive, maybe they can find other incest survivors or other people who have been hurt and help them to come to grips with it. And then again, what you notice is already on the 20th phase, what Enright would say is when you have complete forgiveness, you're still aware of what happened, but you have a decreased negative affect towards the other person, and you have a positive affect in terms of you wish the other person well. You're able to honestly wish the other person well. Now, in some cases, that may be, I wish them well over there. I don't trust them. I don't want to deal with them. It's too dangerous to deal with them. But to still honestly say, you know, even though I'm not dealing with them, I honestly wish them well. And I think that's what NI would see as the more complete sense of forgiveness. Okay, so then to go along, so then, again, this has been, there's been a number of interventions. There's the ones I mentioned. We also did an intervention, and we also did an intervention with inpatient alcoholics. It was a very successful intervention. Well, the other part of this I didn't mention is, so the inpatient intervention was published in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, which is the top clinical psychology journal. The incest survivor study was published in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, which is, again, is the top clinical psychology journal. The it was a bit controversial, but the one where the male partner disagreed with an abortion decision, that also got published in that top journal. So the other thing that NRI's been able to do is publish in top journals within the field, and again, that has really helped to add legitimacy to the whole study. But so we've done with battered women, with married couples, we work with a community-based therapist. Okay, and then now it's kind of exciting. What we've transitioned to is from this base in psychology, NRI is working in Northern Ireland, Milwaukee, and Madison to build a curriculum where, to build a curriculum where teachers can work with kids on forgiveness. Now his role in it, and he's working with his wife who is working on the curriculum, his role in it is to build curriculum where teachers can be effective. My role in it is school counselors, and so what I look at is, and what we found is, we're currently working in Northern Ireland, we're currently working in Milwaukee and Madison, and what we've been finding is that these curriculums help the students, but they mostly help, they're most effective with a broad section of students, but there are a few students, especially students who are especially angry and especially have difficulties with paying attention, have had a harder sense of benefiting from the curriculum, as it makes sense from anyone who's been in a classroom. That the kids who are more, who have a harder time sitting still and listening to any lesson have a harder time sitting still and listening to this lesson. So my role in it is to start looking at school counselors to start doing individual and group interventions with the most difficult kids is my role in it. Bob's role in it is to try to build a curriculum from grades 1 through 10 that teachers can work with. Okay, so that's what I'm saying here. So again, we're trying to write curriculum from 1 to 10. Currently, grades 1, 2, 3, and 5 have been written, and they're working on a middle school curriculum. What he does in that is he uses books and movies to communicate different lessons. And again, it's been used by teachers and it's being developed for counselors. That's what we're currently working on.
How easy is it to train degrees?
So that's a really good question. Let me go ahead and talk a little bit more about the curriculum and then. I would say there's various levels of training. I'll talk about the curriculum and then. So what the curriculum is about is the curriculum isn't necessarily what we would call the full model. So the forgiveness of it is a choice of the full model, and I brought you guys through the full model. Now what we're working on is the idea that it's hard, obviously, for a first grader to necessarily, they're not going to follow these concepts. Okay? And one thing that we've done is in the NRI forgiveness inventory is we take someone who is hurt, someone who's been injured, and we ask you about that experience, and then say 3 months or a year later, we ask you about the same experience. Well, we've tried doing this, so from a scientific point of view, we've tried doing this with children, and for better or for worse, it hasn't worked. What we do is we have, with some students who have had some pretty difficult things, at the level of first grade, it's hard for most of them to explain what happened. And they don't necessarily remember 3 months later. If you have them write down what happened, it's very hard for them to remember 3 months later. Now, we still believe that it affects them. We still believe that, you know, that all these, when bad things happen to them, it affects them. But it hasn't worked to have the same model of going through that incident because they have a harder time recalling it. Okay, so what Bob is trying to do, and what this also works for students who where it's not as clear what happened to them, but he still wants to try to support them and benefit them, is what the curriculum does at the lower levels especially is try to instill in them some basic principles that will help them long term that are consistent with forgiveness. So for example, the first grade curriculum, the first one they wrote, is all about Horton Hears a Who. Now this is actually before the movie, a few years back before the movie was done, but you know, now it's been more popular with the movie, but that's fine. So, you know, for those of you who remember or don't remember, Horton, you know, there's Horton Hears a Who, he there's this dust speck and he hears something going on, he believes something going on, and Horton's mantra is, a person is a person no matter how small. Right? A person is a person. So what the goal with the forgiveness curriculum is all about different lessons, but trying to get that key thing is that a person is a person no matter how small, with the belief that when you get angry at someone, when you feel hurt, you tend to dehumanize them. And what this lesson is trying to get at is if you can see that a person is a person no matter how small, and always believe that a person is a person, you're going to be less likely to dehumanize a person, less likely to lash out in anger. So that's what these kinds of curriculums work on. Okay, as another example, in the third grade curriculum, there's a book called Summer Wheels. It's not that well known, but it's called Summer Wheels, and what it is about is, it's about a person, it's about an old man who has a bunch of bicycles that he's fixed up, and he loans them out to kids for free. And at one point this kid borrows a bicycle. There's a couple of kids who are borrowing the bicycles and always return them back. And one kid borrows a bicycle and just basically destroys it. And it's one of the other kids' favorite bicycles, and they talk through that. And then eventually at the end, the kid brings back the bicycle, and the old man essentially forgives him. But his rule is that you, if you destroy a bicycle, you have to fix it. So the old man works with the child who destroyed the bicycle to repair it. And so what this does is it brings up all sorts of themes about, well, how would you feel if some, you know, what if that was your bicycle? Or what if you, you know, feel empathy towards the characters and talk through, okay, what happens if someone destroys a bicycle and has something like that happen in your life? So take stories and try to talk through the kids about how these principles have interacted in their lives. For some kids, there'll be serious things that come up about forgiveness and anger, in which case we talk it through with them. For other kids, that won't happen. And again, it depends on the context. We're doing this both in the classroom where you're going to hit more people, but there's less an opportunity to talk through things. With counselors, we either have it one-on-one or with small groups, and we have more chance to talk things through. The last example is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where I think most of you have seen that. Obviously, Aslan, Christian allegory. What works about this is they've done this in the public schools. They've had this curriculum in a lot of schools, mostly private schools, but also in public schools, where they'll show the DVD in different sections. They'll talk through what does this mean, and again, with the psychological research, with the kind of the fact that you're using mainstream media, there are public schools that have allowed us to come in and do that. And what we do is we work through the different lessons, work through the different morals as far as what we see in the movie, and then talk that through. And that's why I say here, student reads a part of the story, sees part of the movie, and issues are discussed with students related to forgiveness. So for some kids, it's a very clear sense of I was injured, and we talk through forgiveness. For other kids, it's just talking through general principles of caring for others, general principles of, okay, what happened in the story, you know, the lion got killed, what did that mean, things like that. We're able to give people you know, a greater understanding of forgiveness. So getting back to what you asked about in terms of the training, I would say it's all across the board. I would say we've had successful interventions. The main model and the hope is that we go to a school, that Bob or someone trained in it does a training with the teachers, that they commit to it for about 3 years. They give it to the students for a year. Most of these curriculums are about 10 to 15 lessons that they give over a year. But that has been varied. Sometimes we've had the trainings, they've generally worked. On the other hand, there is also a very important step in terms of how committed the teachers are. Obviously, if a teacher is not as committed and not as interested, it's not going to be as effective. Some teachers, we have not had the opportunity to train. We've given them the book, and it has been successful where some teachers will get the book, they will read it, it will be very important to them, they'll train themselves. And pretty much, when you read the book, if you read the book seriously, you can train yourself in the principles. And then once you get the curriculum, it's up to the teacher to implement it. And obviously some teachers have struggled, but most teachers have found it very successful, and most teachers have really gotten into the curriculum and found it to be very effective. But a lot of it is kind of a baton passing to kind of having the foundation, but then passing off the teacher and saying, okay, if you want to do this, then you can do this or not. Are there questions?
We're going to have an opportunity to ask Tom general questions about education, but this is a good opportunity if you have specific questions that relate directly to what he's talking about. Please feel free at this point. I guess one question I'll start off with, did you include any investigation of background variables that might have affected the results, or was there any observation? Background variables on the part of the students, subject.
So you're thinking like for example, were they from divorced families or something like that, or are they from?
Well, would this be more appropriate or more effective with certain types of individuals as opposed to others?
Okay, and that's good. And so, well, that's a great question, and I would say that's something that we're continuing to research. We haven't done a lot of data collection on that, but that's something we're continuing to do, is saying what are the students that target? And initially our sense is that the most angry students seem to need more attention. So the most angry students seem to need more of the one-on-one or the small group as opposed to the curriculum. That's our main finding at this point. We are trying to find other things of are there different aspects that make people more, as far as background, as far as anger, as far as from a single parent. Well, the one thing that does remind me of is one thing that this will, this is the question, no. Is that from obviously an important aspect is the cultural aspect. One thing that we found to be very helpful is that within the African American school, the families have been much more open to forgiveness interventions than to say cognitive behavioral interventions. We also find that to be, and not to overly generalize, but in general, also within the Latino community, parents have been more open to, hey, forgiveness intervention, that's consistent, we like that idea. We don't like as much the idea of a psychologist giving a cognitive behavioral intervention because we feel like the student must be sick, it's like they're sick and they're getting, and they're disturbed or something. We don't like that. But we know the student's angry. Anger makes sense to us. We're familiar with the idea of forgiveness. We like that idea. So there's a number of multicultural settings where people have been very open to this. Let me say one other thing real quick. Oh, yeah. I did put my business card on the back of this thing. The best resource is this one. So if you're interested in more, you can track down this resource. What I also have is Bob was also written up in Christianity Today. I think it was back in 2000. So I can send people, if people want to read the Christianity Today article, I've got a PDF of that that I can send people. I've got some research articles if people are interested that I can send people. And then the curriculum. If people are teachers and they want to try to implement the curriculum, I can talk to Bob and I can track down and I should be able to send you guys a PDF. So email me if that's interesting to you. Go ahead.
Did you look at behaviors besides anger, such as overachieving or perfectionism? Because some incest survivors don't act out of anger. They do other things.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, within the schools context, we look at anger, anxiety, and depression. So that would tend to be more. So would, they're more internalized problems, you're right, it's going to tend to more be the depression and the anxiety. But in the incest survivors, yeah, no, I would say no. A lot of times there's a lot of, unfortunately, they bring it upon themselves, and it isn't necessarily, the incest survivor would be an example, less of an acting out reaction and more of an internalized reaction. So, but that one was with people aged 18 to 45, I think. So, or maybe even into the 50s. So that was an adult intervention. But you're right that you know, there's a lot of different reactions, and anger isn't necessarily the only one.
So if you're looking at adults and taking this curriculum into the schools, and there's a child being abused sexually, that you don't even know about. So how would this help a teacher understand and minister in Christian legal to a child that is really hurting but cannot express it?
Right, so that
it could be repeated from the time they're 4 till the time they're 11. And you've got all that time that this child's in the school. You've interviewed adults. I'm asking on the front end for all these teachers, for these kids, how can a teacher use what you've got in an intervention?
Right, so, and what's tricky about this and is that what the best setup, and when we do interventions, what you really want to do if you want to do this intervention is make it a team effort with the teacher and certainly the teacher and the principal. You need the principal to be on board. Then also it's helpful if there is a school counselor or a school psychologist or someone else who's on board in terms of that. So for example, that is the thing. If you're starting to talk about forgiveness and it turns out that someone is currently being abused, that's a situation where it's probably beyond the teacher's ability to help them. And being that I train school counselors and then I'm a therapist, in that situation, you definitely can get more complicated. I mean, you're probably looking at potentially looking at a mandatory reporting situation and a lot of complications. And so really what Bob tries to do is find a school where the principal is on board, where there's more than one teacher on board, and where there's a safety net in terms of, a counselor, school psychologist that can deal with the problems that erupt. So that's something to be aware of for those of you who are teachers, is are there other people who are on board with this? Or am I in a situation where other people can join me in this? Because it is going to be hard for a teacher once some of these things come up. And teachers aren't, I think there are ways that teachers can absolutely minister. There are ways the teachers can absolutely get this curriculum and be helpful, but there are some level of hurts that a therapist is more trained for than a teacher. And so that is a complication. And so that, I would say, that would be dependent upon knowing your situation, knowing if you have other people on board who can help you with this.
I know that you talked about the minorities that you worked with, mm-hmm. and I was just wondering, how did you guys handle the bias issue when you How diverse is the team of researchers who go in and work with those students?
So that is tricky in terms of, there's the kids we're working with are mostly African American. Most of the people intervening are European American, so there is that difference. And a lot of what we focus on there, and one thing that we were concerned with is there can be some. There can be a difficulty in terms of we didn't want to be European Americans where people had experienced prejudice and where we were potentially not dealing with the prejudice in the best way possible. And so what I mean by that is when working with African American students, we intentionally found other African Americans that they were angry with. So in other words, with an African American student, what we would find is a mother or a brother or an uncle who they were angry with, and we would deal on that level. Does that make sense of the difference? Because it was, what we didn't want to get into was being a European American person, kind of convincing them to forgive someone who had hurt them, who was European American, and not helping them to deal with racism. So we intentionally did not go over these bounds of, we did not want to do the cross-racial forgiveness because that is the extra dimension of discrimination. So what we focused on was within the African American community, was there someone who hurt you? And I think that was effective and helpful in terms of that worked out well in terms of there definitely was always situations. And the truth of the matter was, in this setting, I would say a very high percentage of all of their relationships were with other African Americans. And so that was mostly what they were interested in. That was mostly what we dealt with.
Does that make sense? I worked on a study with the University of Chicago for the DSM-5, and it hasn't come out yet.
Okay.
And they've been, it's a National Institute of Mental Health study, and one thing they told the lead investigator who read the UNC was that, your entire team is not diverse, and so we don't really think that you're getting what you're supposed to get at the meat of what's going on, because, you mentioned the parents saying something to the degree of, but we don't want the cognitive behavioral stuff, but we'll take this anger management type of, this forgiveness thing.
Right.
And so I think a lot of that comes from the cultural, the cultural aspect of that. Minorities naturally, all the way back in the Tuskegee Institute, those experiments, they don't necessarily trust European psychologists or therapists or, interventions. And so I was just wondering how diverse it was. And I think that, I'm not sure if it's in your limitations, and I'm going to look for the studies, but it seems like it's a huge limitation. And how many biases are being brought into the environment? And this is almost as if, are you telling me this is my concern and then you're helping me with it? You know what I mean? How much of that is going on? So I just, for me right now, I'm seeing it as a limitation, but I like to look at the entire study.
Well, there's a limitation, especially with the students who are with African Americans, but that's something to consider. And we did have, I wish we had a more diverse team, but we did have one person on our team who was African American and who had taught for 6 years as a teacher in the schools in the Milwaukee schools, and definitely was important. She was an important person to consult with and say, okay, what do you think about these different things, and trying to get her perspective. But obviously it's going to be imperfect.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Great.